once again, and welcome to Nikonian's Podcast. We are the Image Doctors. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And this is episode number 53 for November the 8th, 2007.
Welcome, everyone. Couple topics for today's podcast. First, we're going to do a quick overview of the changes that are showing up in Capture NX version 1.3. Not on the market yet, but Jason and I have been playing with it for a few weeks. We've got what we think is a fairly final form of it. And so we'll just talk about what's going on there.
Our kind friends at Nikon said we could talk about it, yep. So we will.
Yep. And then the second thing, for a while we've been promising a beginner segment with a friend of ours, a guy named Renzo, who will join us later in the podcast, and we're just going to talk through a lot of the questions that he has after having used his brand new D40X for about 4 months. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned in that segment, we'll do some later episodes with Renzo as well, talking a little bit about flash, printing, things of that sort.
So, so an exciting episode as always. But let's talk about Capture NX 1.3, our hands-on preview.
Right.
And there's two major advancements in NX 1.3. First of all, let me point out, this is a service release.
Right.
This is not complete overhaul of Capture NX. It's going to be, as far as we know, a free update to Capture NX 1.2. If you haven't updated Capture NX, 1.2 is the current version right now. We'll be updated to 1.3 by the end of November.
Right.
And the reason for that is to add support for the two new cameras, the D3 and the D300.
Right. So that's the primary motivation.
Right. The overall interface, look and feel, none of that has changed. So if you're looking for massive, revisions to the software, this isn't it. This is just a service release. But the one thing that has changed is in the base adjustment section, there's a new feature called picture control.
Right. And it was put in for the D3 and D300, which have that feature as part of the in-camera settings.
Right. The in-camera settings tab, as you know, is different in NX 1.3. The camera settings tab that was on the left-hand side of the window no longer has anything that you can alter.
Right.
Which is kind of a disappointment to me, but on the other hand, as you're going to see, the picture control is pretty good, actually. And what'll happen is if you have a NEF file from a from any camera other than a D300 or a D3, what happens is that the picture control option
is initially
disabled, right? You can turn it on or off, and this is up in the camera settings menu of the base adjustments tab. And there you will find all in one place all of the things that you used to see for the most part in the camera settings: your tone curves, your color modes, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The white balance setting has moved to the raw adjustments tab. Mm-hmm. But then you have the option in the camera settings tab to enable picture control. Now, if you're shooting in a D3 or a D300, the picture control tab is enabled automatically, and you cannot revert back to the old method of adjusting tone.
At least not quite.
No, there's some little things you can do, but you won't have the same controls.
Right.
Now, in the picture control tab, like I said, it's under camera adjustments in the base, and then there's a tab that says picture control. If you open that up, you get a fairly large dialog box, and it has some presets. The presets that are in there are the same ones in View NX.
Right.
Standard, neutral, vivid, and then some ones that are called, and they're in the monochrome, which is black and white. D2X mode 1, 2, and 3. And those D2X mode 1, 2, and 3, those emulate the color modes that you had in the D2X, the D200 earlier cameras. Mm-hmm. So there is a way to get back then.
Just one little fine point. It does not have the A versions, like
right.
mode 1A, mode 3A.
Correct.
Just the mode 1, 2, and 3.
Right. So this is a preset. And when I first saw that, I was kind of... And I had kind of mixed feelings about it, but after playing with the picture control for a while, I find that it works pretty well for a lot of images. Mm-hmm. The next thing you'll see in the picture control is that it has a slider called Quick Adjust, and this is the really if you're not really interested in fooling with things, it's a slider that goes between -2 and +2, And what it does is it adjusts actually contrast, saturation, and sharpening parameters all at once. And you can see its effects on the sliders below it.
So it's just more of everything or less of everything.
Right. More sharpening, less sharpening, more contrast, more saturation, or less that. I usually don't mess with that.
No, I probably would never mess with that one.
And then it has the option to save some presets. You can save presets similar to what you were seeing in the View NX presets. If you've gone into that, you mm-hmm. can bring up that same editor,
right?
That window. Then under the Advanced tab, if you open that, there's where you get your sharpening, contrast, something called brightness, saturation, and hue parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Now the sharpening, let's start with that one because it works much differently in NX 1.3 than it did in previous versions.
Yeah, it does. So these aren't, you know, just trivial changes. They're altering the basic look and feel. And what both of us noticed with the sharpening settings are two primary things. One, the scale is wider. A lot of people felt like the high sharpening settings in the past weren't quite enough. Now, we haven't used the D3 and D300 yet. That'll be soon. But we haven't used those yet. But our guess is that these settings correspond to in-camera settings. And if that's the case, the largest amount of sharpening that you can do will be much higher than it was with previous Nikon cameras.
It is also possible that the in-camera settings will top out at a lower value. So we can't.
Kind of guesswork. Usually they've aligned, so we're presuming that. So the maximum intensity is higher. But what we're also seeing is that the character of this sharpening is a little bit different. It's a little bit higher radius sharpening than what you found in the past with the in-camera settings.
Right. You definitely can start to see it. And I think there's a reason for this. And with high radius sharpening, you tend to accentuate large shape details, mm-hmm. you know, big edges, and not every fine little tiny detail that's, you know, in the image. Mm-hmm. And then this has a profound impact, as we mentioned before when we talked about noise reduction, on how noisy an image will look.
Right.
Because this sharpening setting is going to tend to not accentuate the graininess of the luminous noise mm-hmm. in images.
Now, one of the things that we found is that because you can go higher in intensity and it's a little bit higher radius sharpening, that this control is more like a combination of doing that capture level sharpening as well as output sharpening. If those terms aren't familiar to you, look for the podcast that we did a while back on sharpening. I think we spent a whole episode on it and went into lots and lots of detail. But it's more of a combined control. And so theoretically what someone could do if they chose to and didn't want to mess a lot with sharpening techniques is just crank up the sharpening a little bit, and that would suffice for both capture and output sharpening together, going to a printer.
Yeah, and I
it's
think...
Probably not something that we would choose to do. We like a little bit more control. But I think that's what Nikon is trying to do here.
And what I'm seeing is sort of my general thoughts about picture control, having played with it now, is that for a lot of images, you can use this one palette and get pretty close to a good enough to print image. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it now, depending on how what controls you will have in camera, but if you think about the picture control settings, if they are implemented in the camera, if you wanted to shoot JPEG, it could make it pretty easy to get very good out of the box JPEGs, mm-hmm. potentially, mm-hmm. Without having seen some of these new cameras.
Yeah.
There's also, I should point out, with all of the parameters for the Advanced tab, the sharpening, contrast, and saturation, you have a little box you can click auto sharpen, auto contrast, mm-hmm. And you can let the program try to figure out what's best.
Being control freaks, we like doing it for ourselves.
But. And what I've found, and you can still disable sharpening, so I can set it to zero and then do the sharpening routines as I'm used to doing, mm-hmm. and I can get perfectly good results with these images.
Mm-hmm. Now, other general character things with the image, both of us also immediately spotted the fact that it's applying different kinds of tone curves to the images than mm-hmm. was the case in the past, whether in camera or in NX. And specifically, it's lifting the mid-range tones, especially the upper mid-range tones. And so what you'll see is just an overall brightening of the image that's going on, making it a little bit punchier. And in the past, a lot of people used custom curves in their cameras, especially like with the D70, the D100, et cetera, to do that. And so this is kind of doing the same thing. Most images that I tried with it actually benefited from that mm-hmm. little bump in the mid-range, so I don't think that's a bad thing at all.
So you have a contrast slider with values between -3 and +3, so you mm-hmm. get 7 mm-hmm. contrast settings. So it can go, and I think from playing with this that if you set it all the way down to -3, you're getting lower contrast than even the low contrast tone curve mm-hmm. In the original camera settings parameters. Mm-hmm. And then there's a control called brightness. But what I think this is not really brightness as we're used to seeing a brightness slider. It only goes between 0, -1, and 1. But what it looks to me like is that this is actually a gamma boost.
Right.
And talking with some people, they suggest that's what it's doing. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't give you that overcooked brightness if you crank it up. It just sort of boosts the mid-tones a little bit mm-hmm. or lowers them a little bit. So
just fine-tunes them.
Yeah, it's definitely a fine-tuned setting. It keeps things within tasteful boundaries, I think. Mm-hmm. By default, as we move to the last section, is the saturation. By default, the saturation seems to be a little more intense than what I'm used to seeing
right.
with the regular camera settings.
Right, and I think there's maybe a similarity there with what we were talking about sharpening, where the saturation levels are more like what you would need to have in a final print. You know, because when you print, you lose a little bit of saturation. So I think it's compensating for that with the settings. The vivid setting is definitely zowie. You know,
yeah,
it's a lot of saturation.
It's a lot.
You might want to dial that one back a little bit, although a lot of people will love it the way it is.
Right. And what I found is that with the standard preset, depending on the image, the saturation, sometimes I'll even tone it down mm-hmm. one notch. And you get the range between 3 and -3 mm-hmm. on that. And then there's a hue adjustment slider. So if you want to change the hue to make things look a little bit more greenish or a little bit more magenta looking, you can apply that as well.
Yeah.
And then within the picture control, you can save your own custom presets.
Right.
So if you find something that you like, so one of the things I did was I took the neutral setting, which is fairly flat, and I think it will work well for portraits, mm-hmm. And then just turned sharpening to 0 and said, okay, that's the one I'm going to apply. Mm-hmm. So it's having a preset within the control.
Yeah. In some respects, you can think of the neutral, standard, and vivid settings being the functional equivalents of modes 1, 2, and 3. They're not the same.
No.
But in terms of intended use, kind of the same general territory, but the color rendition is different, as is the other settings.
So that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, and we'll learn more as we use it. I think certainly when we get our hands on the D3 and D300, we'll learn a little bit more there too. There's some things that we need to see in conjunction with those cameras to completely figure it out. Now, you know, we had gotten some questions over the last week or so about things that people wanted to hear about in this podcast. And there were certainly some questions about compatibility with the new Mac software release, Leopard, right? Mm-hmm.
And I'm running that right now as
right.
we record this.
Right.
I upgraded to Leopard yesterday, and so far it hasn't broken anything.
Right.
Other than a few minor, you know, the normal install anytime you upgrade your OS. Mm-hmm. The fact that I've had so few issues is actually pretty good.
Yeah, but we're sitting here looking at 1.3 running on Leopard and seems
right.
to be doing
now,
fine.
Officially, Nikon doesn't support it.
Right.
That doesn't mean that it won't run. Mm-hmm. It just means that if you run into a glitch that is caused by the OS, they won't guarantee that it works. But generally, with all these things, within the next 90 days, Nikon will probably have support for it. They will have all the kinks worked out and it'll be in the hands of more users. Now, there's That's the picture control in NX. The other thing I mentioned that some of the tools that have moved to the raw adjustments section in bass adjustments now. That includes the white balance setting. Didn't used to be there, along with your exposure compensation, which
it works more or less the same.
Always was there. Yeah,
I didn't see any differences. Really. There's
one new tool that's in here, and that's the active delighting control, and that is under the raw adjustments tab in the bass adjustments palette, and that is something I'm still trying to learn. The way that the active delighting works is. It has to be turned on in the camera for it to be available to you in NX. I think it has something to do with the actual sensor data itself. I don't know.
Well, this is one of those things that we'll have to wait.
Right. We'll have to revisit this.
Yeah. You can't use it with one of the older cameras.
Correct.
It's grayed out.
It's grayed out if you're using an older camera. And if you're using a D3, you can turn it on and you get the settings of, you get three preset options. Well, you can have off, but then there's also low, normal, and high. So you can change it around a little bit. But as I was also found, because I was playing with a few D3 NEFs that are floating out there on the web. Most of them aren't very good images, but they're out there. What I noticed was that at least one D3 image came up with the active delighting control was grayed out. So the way I take that I perceive that is that it was turned off in the camera, and therefore I can't turn it on after the fact.
Right.
So clearly that control, that active delighting, we'll have to learn more about.
Yeah. Although even in that case, we don't know about the maturity of the firmware that was
correct. So
the camera that took the photo. So you know,
I'm guessing
a lot of
on
guesswork.
That. We're speculating there, yeah. So take that with a grain of salt. But that's what it seems to be at this point, if I had to guess.
Yeah. So, you know, wrapping up 1.3, it's just a free upgrade, you know, and primarily oriented against the D300 and D3 capabilities. Because of that picture control utility, it does have some changes in the basic settings, and you'll want to spend some time exploring it, playing with it, creating new settings files,
right?
You know, all of those kind of things. So it's not quite as trivial as previous releases.
No, but it seems to be pretty stable. So
yeah,
I'm fairly happy with it. And like you were saying, a lot of my images do seem to have a little more pop and punch
right.
when I use the picture control settings. It's just learning, as with anything, it's learning how to dial it in to get the result that you want, seasoned to taste.
Yep. Anything else you can think of?
Nope. I've heard that it should be available by the end of this month, presumably by the time the D300 starts shipping.
Yep.
And we're looking at, speaking of that, we're looking at D300 shipping from Nikon to dealers on or about the 21st of November, for what I'm hearing.
And I'm hearing about a week later for D3s. So
we'll see what
fun
happens.
Times ahead.
Yeah. Okay. That concludes this section. So we want to move on. And what we've done is we've invited our good friend Renzo to the Mountain Stronghold. And we're going to talk to him for the next few minutes about his D40 experiences.
Yep. Well, welcome, Renzo. We're glad to have you here today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm pleased to be here.
One of the things that we thought is that we would talk a little bit about your photographic background, things that you did in the past, why you decided to start back into photography. And then I know you bought a D40X and you've got an HP B9180 printer, some good stuff. If you could talk to us a little bit about, you know, what your thought process was behind the camera selection and things like that. And then I know you've got a list of questions for us, and then we'll go right into that. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, great.
It's kind of funny, though. You asked me about my photographic experience, and I really don't have much, and I'm just trying to get into it right now. So I'm really in the learning process. I'm trying to learn as much as I can. I found it really interesting when I went out to try to purchase my camera that I have, the DX D40X. There were a few features that I really wanted to have on that camera, one being digital, the other being exchangeable lenses. I didn't want to get into fixed lenses. And the other ones, because it's between myself and my wife, we both wanted to be able to do point and shoot as well as to do some manual operations to be able to take advantage of the camera. Mm-hmm. So that was some of the criteria. And then really probably one of the important items too was the cost, is I wanted to be able to get a good unit for the least expense possible. And so I drew a line, a budget line, about $1,500 mm-hmm. As I was going through. Most importantly, though, from a use standpoint, my son's involved in competitive soccer, and I really wanted to be able to take his action shots. We bought several of the small end cameras, you know, no exchangeable lenses and all that. You take a shot, and then you have to wait 3-4 minutes before mm-hmm. you can take the next shot. Well, the D40X solved that problem for me. Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why I picked that camera.
Well, it's funny with, you know, some of the things that you were just mentioning, you probably match 90% of new DSLR owners right there with everything that you mentioned. So it's a very yeah. common set of needs.
You get tired of waiting for the shutter lag on the point and shoot cameras, or it doesn't focus where you want it to, or by the time it takes the picture, the play is already gone. Your kid's already out of the frame, and that right. I hear that from a lot of people.
Well, that's exactly what drove me to this. Is my last picture I took of him, he was going in for a goal. I took the picture, thought I had a great picture of him taking the goal, and he made the goal. And I looked at the picture afterwards. He wasn't even in the shot.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that'll happen for sure.
But then the other thing that was really fascinating as I was looking for cameras, I asked people for advice on the cameras. And I learned more about what the cameras can do. And I learned about this thing called vibration reduction. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of the things I said, I got to have in my camera because I shake a lot when I take a picture.
Right.
So when I heard about it and the way it was explained to me, sound like a great thing.
Yeah, especially if you're using a longer lens. And I know you've got one of the newer 70 to 300 VR lenses. That's where it really helps. And a lot of people were disappointed with their photos in the past using long lenses and never were quite sure why the photos weren't crisp.
Well, that's in my case, is my son being out on the field, on the soccer field. I'm at the end of one point of that. He's mm-hmm. probably 50 to 75 yards out. I'm out at that 300 zoom, mm-hmm. and my pictures are coming in great.
Yeah.
I mean, just taking that, and I don't have to worry about my shake. Oh, and that's super. Without even using, I did buy a the single tripod.
The monopod,
uh-huh. yes. And I don't even use that very mm-hmm. much because I do get such great quality from that VR. Yeah. So.
Well, if it works for you without it, that's great because you can get a little bit more mobility. Okay. Well, you want to dive into some specific questions that you have now? Now, how many months has it been since you got the D40X?
I've had it for 4 months, uh-huh. and I do have a ton of questions because I think probably the finding the camera and finding what I wanted was probably the easiest part of this whole mm-hmm. process. The education has been the hardest part. The manual that came with the camera, I'd give it probably about a C rating.
Right.
And it's just a start. Then what I did is I went out and tried to find some books for teaching me on the camera itself. Very few on the camera itself. Mm-hmm. But then I found some few basic photography mm-hmm. books. And I bought those and started to learn a little bit. But by all means, there's a lot that I have to learn. So that's where my questions come into play.
Well, one of the challenging things, but it's also a fun thing about photography is there's a tremendous amount to learn, and you never have to stop learning. There's always something more, to add to your experience.
Right. And as I mentioned, this D40X is a featureful camera. Mm-hmm. It provides me a lot of features. So really my first question that I had coming into this is, it provides all of these features, but which ones do I really care about, and why do I care about
yeah.
those?
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's true, and I think we may have mentioned this in previous podcasts a little bit, is very few photographers will use all the features on a camera.
Right.
It's just not that common. What most people do is they'll have certain kinds of photography that they settle into. And in your case, you've mentioned the sports photography, and there's a certain set of settings that work well for that. Family photography, another thing. And again, there's just kind of like a basic set. And what a lot of people will do is just have a few basic sets that they'll go back and forth between, but not use everything on there. I would view the features of the camera as more tailoring it to your needs as opposed to things that you're going to switch off every single time. That's the more common situation. Yeah. And it simplifies things a little bit if you view it that way.
I have a couple of settings in my camera that I do presets, but you know, you get four choices of presets, you know, where it assembles a range of functions, mm-hmm. and those are tailored to the kinds of shooting that I do. So if I'm shooting wildlife, I'll set the camera up one way, and then if I'm shooting landscapes, I'll set it up slightly different way. But it all comes down to probably the most fundamental thing that you want to find out is which exposure mode to use. That, you know, whether to put the camera in program, manual, aperture, or shutter priority. And that has a huge bearing on what your subject will have a large influence on where you should set up your camera.
Mm-hmm. Now, for sports photography, like you were mentioning, you're generally going to do, you know, very well using the program mode or using the shutter speed priority exposure mode. And incidentally, we've talked a little bit about those in the previous podcast. Jason, what was the episode number?
We talked about it most recently in episode 44, which was the episode that mm-hmm. we had for July 5th, 2007. But we also talked about it in 2006 in episode 13. Mm-hmm. So those are, if you want an in-depth review on all the exposure modes in the cameras, those would be some good
But just some quick things on that. In program mode, it'll just pick, you know, a reasonable combination of shutter speed and aperture, one that's, you know, a good general purpose thing. And for a lot of shots, including the family stuff, things like that, that'll work fine.
And that's as close to point and shoot as you'll get.
Right.
You know,
right.
Just put it on P and it does its thing. If it needs the flash, I believe the flash will just pop up automatically. When you start tailoring it to where you say, I'm going to a specific type of shooting, like the soccer game, then setting something into shutter priority probably would make a little more sense. Mm-hmm. Because that gives you the control where you know you need to tell the camera that you're interested in freezing the action in this case. So shutter priority with a shutter speed of anything from a 500th of a second on up, but mm-hmm. preferably a 1,000th of a second, or better if mm-hmm. you really want to freeze the action. And then what the camera will do is it will vary the aperture in the lens as needed to make sure that the shutter speed is maintained.
Mm-hmm. Now, in combination with those settings, you've got the ISO setting that you'll want to have set to one that's fast enough to stop that action. And, if you're not getting 500th or 1,000th of a second in program mode, or if when you put it in shutter speed priority mode, your lens isn't fast enough, it doesn't have a wide enough opening to support those shutter speeds, you'll just want to increase that ISO from, you know, a minimum of 200 up to 400 or 800. All of those can give you very nice results.
Especially with the D40X.
Yeah.
Which has very good, clean performance mm-hmm. All the way up to ISO 1600. So if you're in a situation where you need it, just use it. I mean, it's a tool. Yeah. It's the difference between not getting the shot. Otherwise, use it.
Now, you'll get a little bit nicer colors and a little bit better clarity when you use a lower ISO, but don't be afraid of the higher ones.
You know, it's really funny with this new camera, digital camera. 25-plus years ago, I used the old SLR film cameras, and I had a Canon camera at that time. Mm-hmm. The ISO is the only one I'm really familiar with, because that was the most important back then.
Right.
Well, then you had to pick it, too, because you had to make sure you set it on the camera to match the film that you were using. And
pick out the film.
I mean, here with digital, you can go back and forth. You can take one frame at ISO 100 and then the next one at 1600, and you could never do that with film. You'd have to change film to do that.
Yeah. No, that's great advice, what you give me on how to approach that. There's one other thing that, you know, the nice thing about my camera is that I have a 2 gigabyte storage card, mm-hmm. and I can swap in as many as I want, and mm-hmm. I haven't even come close to filling that up. Mm-hmm. But what resolution should I be taking all of my shots on? I think I've got it set at the highest resolution. Right. Is that the correct resolution I should be doing?
I think so. In general, it if you know that you're never going to do anything with the photos other than posting them on the web, and there you're talking usually 600 or 800 pixels in the longest dimension, you could reduce it. My philosophy is you can always delete images that you don't like, and I would rather have flexibility to do whatever I wanted with an image. If I really like something, you know, maybe I want to make a big print of it, and I won't always know that in advance. So in my case, I both Jason and I shoot the raw mode, which I know you're going to ask a little bit about later. And in that case, you're always at the highest resolution, at least with current Nikon file formats. I like that, and even if I was shooting JPEG, I'd still pick the highest one just for that flexibility.
Yeah, I would too.
I would go,
because quite frankly, like you were saying, I mean, you've yet to fill a card, and the price of memory now is so much cheaper than it was 2 or 3 years ago, even.
At the 4 months ago or so that you bought the camera, it's dropped.
Right.
It's amazing. So, I mean, I think a 2 gig card for the D40 is, I don't know, $49 or something now for a good one, for a fast card. You know, we're not talking about I'm talking name brand stuff.
Yeah.
So there's no excuse not to shoot in the highest quality, because it's easier to, it just gives you more stuff to work with later on. You can always make the image smaller, you know, but you can't go the other direction.
Sure.
You'll lose quality if you try to take a small image. So I would recommend the largest size and then the fine, you know, the JPEG, large, fine setting. Well,
you know, when it comes to the memory storage cards, I thought I knew what I was doing. At least that's one area that I had knowledge of. But as I started searching for one, I found that there's specialized ones when you talk about the speeds, especially if I wanted to take the sports shots, that you had to buy a certain type of memory card that meets that. And the price range that you quoted is right on, is what I found.
Yeah.
But given that, that same vein or thread is, I was also, one of the things that I learned way back is I needed to buy a cover or a filter for my cameras to protect the lenses. And, you know, I thought I'd just go out and say, yeah, I want a filter and I want a clear filter and I want it to do this. Well, both of my lenses have that on it, but it took a lot of time because there's a lot of filters out there.
Mm-hmm.
What type of filters would I want to buy in the future, and why would I want to buy those particular filters? You know, like they got the blue filters, the sky filters, the black filters, and all that.
Well, quite honestly, Renzo, with digital photography, you don't need as many of the color modifying filters anymore. A lot of those filters are most useful for film, especially the skylight filters or the warming filters, and all of those effects you can achieve now by just setting the white balance properly in your camera or adjusting the white balance if you shoot raw after the fact.
And even with a JPEG, you can just make the photo a little bit warmer or a little bit cooler.
So that, I wouldn't worry about those as much. There's debate about the whole protective filter thing. I know Rick and I are not particularly proponents of the protective filter, because they break. Lenses don't break. And we use our lens hoods. And that's one piece of advice to all of the newer photographers out there. I can't tell you how many people I see when I'm on vacation. And they got this great camera. It doesn't matter if it's a Nikon or a camera. And they're shooting it with the lens hood reversed. You know, and the bayonet mount it's reversed. It's in its stowed position. You'll get a lot better pictures, especially in sunny conditions, just by using the lens hood, because it keeps those reflections off. Yeah. And
one thing I will say is I think both of us are pretty careful with our stuff.
True.
We're good about putting lens caps on and stuff. And I've known people that, you know, just have a horrible time remembering to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And probably in their case, you know, getting the protective filter is not a bad idea.
Yeah. I mean, certainly they don't hurt anything.
No.
But one thing you have to keep in mind is that any time, I mean, you pay a lot of money for some good optics and you put a cheap piece of glass protective filter on there, it's going to increase the chance that you're going to get flare or ghosting. You know, it introduces a new refractive surface into the optical path. So you want to try to get coated filters whenever possible, even if you're just buying, you know, a clear or UV filter, get them that say MC, multi-coated, and get that version of it, because they'll just transmit light better. The one filter that we always recommend for anybody, if you're interested in doing creative stuff, is a polarizing filter. That's the one where you can rotate the polarizer to change the effect. And this will make skies darker, adds contrast. If you got blue skies and white clouds, it'll add a little more contrast in the skies. And then the other thing that it does that you absolutely cannot do in software later on is it removes glare from surfaces, whether it's leaves on trees or reflections on water. A polarizing filter really helps there. So if that's the kind of thing that you want to take more of those kinds of pictures, that's the one filter that we never leave without.
Yeah. And it's not something that you'll use all the time. You don't want to.
No, and you don't want to use it for portraits or anything like that. It makes skin look kind of funny.
You know, when I placed my order, when I was online, and that's what I found too, is buying locally, I found the prices were a lot more expensive. So I did a lot of searching online to find my cameras. I found a website called Robert's Camera website, and that's where I had purchased all my products from. And they have a whole list of all these filters that we talked about. I almost bought the polarizing filter. It had a lot of great qualities with it. But then I also looked at the cost compared to what I was doing for the clear filter, and I decided until I learn a little bit more, I'd go with the clear filter. And I'm one of those people that sometimes forget my cap. I let my kids use the camera too because I want them to learn with it. So I felt it was worth my investment.
Yeah. And there are times when a clear filter for protect it was a lot better than getting fingerprints on grease.
Yeah. Like I said, I've absolutely known photographers where after seeing them using their stuff, I thought, thank God they're using one.
You know, you guys have talked a lot about
we do that
the wrong. About the RAW versus the JPEG, and I know you had shared some information with me on taking RAW photography earlier today on that. But why would I want to shoot RAW versus the JPEG? And I did read about that you can get the JPEG out of the RAW, so I understand that part. But what's the benefits other than...
Yeah, first of all, there isn't a right or wrong format. And for certain photographers have certain interests, JPEG can be the right choice. So it's not a black and white thing. What it comes down to is that JPEG, for straightforward photography where you're not going to be doing a lot with the image later, and the lighting is pretty simple, like out in daylight, and soccer pictures, frankly, for the most part, JPEG will work great. And the file size is smaller, so you can get more images on a card. And you don't even have to do any post-processing with them necessarily.
Right.
So that's the good part about JPEGs, and those are some compelling things for a lot of people. The benefit with RAW, and like we were saying earlier, we use RAW almost exclusively, I think, for our shots. If your white balance is a little bit off, or a lot off, you can fix that non-destructively. It turns out with RAW files, and I know you'll understand this part, it just tags against the basic information. The actual file is never changed. So what happens is instead of doing the processing in your camera and setting the white balance, setting the sharpening, setting the contrast level, setting the color rendition, all that happens on your computer instead. And 2 years later, you can say, hey, I decided I learned something new and I don't like that color rendition or the way it was originally sharpened. I'll just change that.
Or new software has come out with tools that didn't exist 2 years ago.
Which has absolutely happened.
The way I look at it, JPEG or RAW, is where does the processing happen? You can think of a JPEG as being the same thing as a print that you get from your local drugstore. Only the camera was the processor. The camera produces that print, and anything that it does, whether it's the white balance, the exposure, the colors, are effectively baked into that image. You can tweak them later on, but you're given a lot less latitude. It's kind of like if you've ever scanned a picture, from a print and tried to mess with it in Photoshop. If the print was out of focus or exposed wrong, there's not a lot you can do about that after the fact. Now, you can't change focus in RAW, but on the other hand, you can think of the RAW file as being an undeveloped negative, and your computer then is the lab, and you develop it there, which gives you a lot more latitude to produce an image the way you want to.
So there again, from a novice like myself, if I shoot RAW, will it still store the settings that it would have used if it would have done a process of that, such that if I take it offline, I don't have to know all that mumbo jumbo to set and be able and to just print that?
It depends.
The answer is it depends. It's yes and no. I mean, the answer is yes, it has all the settings in the file. The it depends part comes from which software that you use to then go and process that RAW file. If you use Nikon software, which right now is something, well, if you use any of the Nikon software modules, like in Nikon VueNX or in Picture Project that came with your camera, right, or their top-end RAW editing program, which is called Capture NX, those programs will read the way that the file was set up in your camera. So it'll apply the tone curve, you know, for the contrast and the white balance and everything perfectly.
And that's a very common request, you know, especially for photographers that are new to digital, is ideally what they want is for the RAW file to start off where the JPEG would have been. And if that JPEG would have been fine, you know, you don't even have to do anything in
just
RAW.
Hit convert it and it makes it a JPEG.
You know, I did get the Capture NX. They had a demo copy for 30 days. Mm-hmm. I did bring that down because I wanted to see how I could manipulate the files and then actually utilize the full features of this HP B9180 that I have. And and together it really gave me a lot of good prints. But I'm that type of person that sometimes I'm too busy and I don't want to mess. I just want to print that picture. So yeah, that was one of my concerns about shooting.
Sure,
RAW,
sure. And that's JPEG. A common concern. What you can do if you're using NX is just run a batch job and just say, hey, I want to convert everything that I just shot using RAW over to a bunch of JPEGs.
And it'll use the settings that are already embedded in those files, and you don't have to do
JPEGs anything. Will look virtually identical to what you would have had. So you can do that. You can go off and get a drink, cup of coffee, come back later. It's pretty easy. Now, if you're using one of the other software packages, and there are a bunch of popular ones, things like Lightroom are really popular these days, it will not read those settings. What you do there instead, and this does take a little bit more knowledge up front, is you have to create some preset configurations that'll give you the look and feel of what you want. So you have to figure out the tone curves, the sharpening settings, the color rendition, all that kind of stuff. Once you've done that, it's pretty easy, but it does take a little bit.
You have to spend the initial effort to do the tweaking to figure out what you want and what looks good to save as that preset. And once you have the preset, then you can just apply it to all.
And there are virtues with both software packages, honestly. It's not like one is good, one is bad. They're both good in different ways.
Yeah, it sounds like that we have to have another discussion on offline processing and printing. Yeah. But you know what? The other thing on RAW.
And by the way, I think we will do at least another segment on printing.
That sounds good to me. I'd like to hear that.
You're always welcome in the studio.
Right? Yeah, thanks. The other thing that concerned me about RAW versus JPEG, and you just leaned on it, is the size.
Mm-hmm.
So when I weigh the processing that you have to do to get the JPEG versus the size of what the RAW, am I about at the same speed of storage and being able to retake my next picture when I'm out there? Or do I have a better if I stay with RAW since I'm not doing that processing on my camera?
No, ironically, it's almost always going to be a little bit faster with JPEG.
With JPEG?
Yeah.
Yeah. The files are a little smaller, and so they write to the card a little bit more quickly. Now, if you're using a fast memory card, like I use the SanDisk Extreme 3 or Extreme 4 cards in the newer cameras, then usually you can still get quite a few images in RAW. I mean, I believe the D40X shoots at 2.5 or 3 frames per second. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly.
It's 3 frames per second.
3 frames per second. And so most of the time what I've found, because I was shooting a football game yesterday for a friend of mine, and even with my buffer in RAW, my D2X, which is, I think, 17 frames, rarely, if ever, do I fill it. Do I shoot off 17 frames in a row? Now, where you can get it full is if you're doing a lot of bursts in a short amount of time, and it, you know, it has that little bit of a backlog. Mm-hmm. But honestly, at 3 frames a second, for the kind of stuff that you're doing, unless you're really just holding the trigger down and, you know, spray and pray technique, you're probably not going to run into too many issues, although you will have a larger buffer if you shoot JPEG.
I got to laugh because I do use that spray when I'm down there because I want to make sure I get that shot into the goal. So
you can almost hear the monkeys on the typewriters, huh?
There's a couple other questions that I'd really like to ask if I can.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've read a lot on flash photography, and you know what? Flash photography seems to me to be an art on its own.
It is.
I mean, it's definitely the difference between night and day, if I could use that, that term. But one of the things that I did notice, especially with my camera, is that since I like the point and shoot quite a bit, and I leave it in the automated mode, that when I'm at the dusk areas or in a gym or an auditorium, I have to take it off of that, and I have to tell it to take off the flash. Mm-hmm. And I get a better quality picture as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand why. Maybe you can explain that to me.
Well, I think some of it has to do with the range of the flash. When you're in program mode, which is what a point-and-shoot camera is essentially all the time, unless you have a really fancy one, it sees how much light is available, and it makes a decision for you. It says, gee, it's kind of low light. I think I need to use the flash. But those little tiny flash units that are in the point-and-shoots or even in the pop-up flash, they're not that powerful. They don't have a whole lot of range.
No, usually, you know, with those, you're talking
10 feet or less.
Yeah.
You know, anything less than, you know, anything, you know, more than 12 to 15 feet away, and you just don't have the range. And so you just get a dark image that doesn't come out.
Right.
When you tell it to disable the flash, the camera says, well, gee, I guess I need to adjust the aperture or the shutter speed or the ISO setting or all of the above, and sometimes you'll come out with a slightly better picture. Where you have to be careful is if it chooses a shutter speed that's too slow and you'll get a blurred image.
Exactly. Now, you know, one thing about flash, a lot of people find this to be true, is they don't like that look of the brightly lit subject in the foreground and the really dark, almost black background. Sometimes it can look good. A lot of times people find that looks unnatural, and that's where they like shooting without the flash and using what's called available light.
Well, I'll tell you, I was really surprised. And I'll give you an example. We were outside of the auditorium, pitch dark, not pitch dark, but dark mm-hmm. out, and all it had was the outside street light mm-hmm. lighting up the area. I took a picture of the graduates mm-hmm. by a tree with the flash. And it looked like night, and the flash, you know,
it
didn't come out. The quality of the people came out well, but you could tell it was at night. Mm-hmm. As soon as I took the flash off and I took the picture, you would swear that that picture was done in the daylight.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it just really amazed me that that happened.
Right.
So I'd like to have a deeper discussion, just like the printer, on flashes at some time.
Okay, because I think we can do that.
There's so many flashes out there. They're digital, they're non-digital, they're low range, long range, they're widespread, they're synchronized, not synchronized, and I just don't know where to go, which one to buy.
Some really quick things, and I like the idea of coming back to it, because it is a popular topic. I think probably both of us would recommend get one of the Nikon flashes, like an SB600, or if you want to spring for one that's really good, the 800. And with both of those flashes, not only do they have plenty of range, so you can shoot, you know, 40 feet away, 50 feet away, depending on the circumstances. But they've also got controls built into them and built into the camera that allow you to vary the flash intensity so that you can make it look more natural and just kind of blend into the scene. The background is nicely exposed, but you just get enough light to get rid of the shadows and things like that in the faces, and it's, you know, called fill flash.
And your pop-up flash on your D40 will do that.
Oh, yeah.
It just isn't as powerful as... and if you're looking for just to have a flash, there's a SB400 unit, which came out with the D40. It was developed to be a low-cost Nikon speed light. It's not quite as full featured as the SB600 mm-hmm. or 800, but it's still much more powerful and can give a lot of good looks with that.
Yeah, and just a quick assignment, you know, a thing to play with before we come back and do that topic in the future. Look for a feature in your instruction book that has to do with flash exposure compensation. And just take a picture of one of your kids and start dialing in negative flash exposure compensation. You know, start with just what it does automatically, and then dial in, let's say, minus 0.7, minus 1 2/3. Just try that and watch what happens. And I think you might like the look that you start
to get. And you can do this on a bright, sunlit day.
Well, I that's what I'm just going to point out. Another thing that I learned about flash that mm-hmm. really fascinated me, and I've actually used it now, is, you know how you always take a picture of somebody in the sunlight and it comes out terrible?
Right.
Well, mm-hmm. they said, well, pop up your flash and use your flash. I've done that several times mm-hmm. now, and it's like the sun was never there.
Right.
It just takes a good quality picture.
Yeah. The last thing, and again, we'll try to do a special topic, is if you get one of those accessory flashes, look for one that will allow you to bounce the flash off of the ceiling, off of a wall. It diffuses the light and makes it much nicer if you're inside. Right. But special topic.
Okay, and then here's my last question.
Yep. And these are great questions, by the way.
I not only sports pictures, but I'm out there, you know, taking pictures. And, you know, occasionally I like to take a picture of an insect or a flower or something. Mm-hmm. And I try to get my camera to go into macro mode. And I seem to have a hard time getting it into that macro mode. According to what I hear on that is, read, I should say, not hear, is that it should go into like 3 to 4 inches or something to be able to take that shot. So,
well, Renzo, now you've come across one of these issues that this is the difference between the point-and-shoot cameras and the digital SLRs. And what limits your ability to get close is the focusing properties of the lens itself. And in a lot of the point-and-shoot cameras, they have the ability to focus down to a couple of inches, and there's a macro mode you can just enable. Mm-hmm. On the digital SLRs, there is no macro mode setting for the camera itself.
Well, it's good to hear, because I tried looking.
Instead, it's a property of the lens that you use. And so, and we've had some episodes previously on macro photography. And there are you know, many of the lenses out there, they will have a minimum focus distance. So you can look that up in the spec sheet. It'll say minimum focus distance 3 feet, or 4 feet, or if it's some of them, it's 12 feet. It just depends on the lens itself. And, you know, with your 70 to 300, I think you can focus down pretty close. But there's a couple of tips that you'll need to use. One is, anytime you use macro photography, you're trying to really close up, you'll probably want to use a tripod or some kind of support, because it's really hard to hold the image steady enough. There's the concept of depth of field. It's how much of the image is in focus varies by f-stop. As you focus closer and closer on something, as you get closer to your subject, the depth of field gets smaller and smaller. Right. And so usually for macro photographies, for folks taking pictures of insects, they will stop the lens all the way down. They'll put it into aperture priority mode, stop the lens all the way down to f16 or f22 or whatever it might be. And then the problem then that you have is getting enough light on the subject, because you might be using a slow shutter speed. Again, another reason why a tripod would come in really handy for extreme close-ups.
Right. But, you know, while we were talking, I put your 70 to 300 on your camera. And with this lens, you can get to just under, you know, 1.5 meters or 5 feet. And if you have the lens set at 300 millimeters, just take a look at, you know, this object over here and see about how close you can get. And, you know, a little bit further away, yeah, just back right up.
No, I see that. And I'm probably about 4 feet away.
Yeah. And so on that kind of a setting, you'll do very well, you know, shooting flowers and things like that, or even bugs. So just with what you have right now, you can do it. It's not a special macro mode. It's just using the longest focal length. VR will really help if you're, you know, mm-hmm. hand-holding it, as opposed to using a tripod like Jason mentioned. But you'll do
fine. And then there's accessories that if you really want to, you know, get more into doing extreme close-up photographies, like small bugs and spiders and stuff like that, you know, scales on insects, they make, there are things called diopter filters that you would screw into the front of the lens that can effectively allows you to focus the lens closer. It changes the optical properties of the lens. There are things called extension tubes, which are just, it's exactly what it is. It's just a ring with a lens mount on it. It's just empty space.
Right.
And you can put that between your lens and the body. And there's some that you can buy that that aren't very expensive, that they will retain the electrical connections between the camera and the lens, and still allow you to focus and use VR and autofocus properly. And that also, that moves the lens farther away from the camera and makes it focus closer. Mm-hmm. The trade-off is that you're giving up the ability to focus far away when you put those accessories on. on. So the only, you know, the real true way of doing it to have your cake and eat it too is to buy an honest to God macro lens. But they are not cheap. I want to say that the new 105 VR macro lens costs about $800, right?
Yeah, something.
Something like that. Now you can get them. You can get, not, you know, you don't have to buy the newest, latest, and greatest. Nikon makes a lot of really good macro lenses. And even...
And other companies do too. Tamron, right, and Sigma, Tokina all make very good macro lenses. None of them make bad ones.
Right. Now to keep in mind, you're using a D40X. And so to get autofocus function with your lenses, you need to purchase a lens that has the AFS designation.
Sure. Good point.
So otherwise you're using manual focus.
Yeah, which isn't bad for macro.
In fact, a lot of times it's really good for macro because you know, you're just going to set the focus. Yeah.
I almost always use manual focus for macro.
So you had another question, seems.
No, that like I say, I thought the macro was going to be my final question, but since you pulled out my camera and did that, you know, it's got the A and M setting, uh-huh, on the lens. I assume automatic and manual. Mm-hmm. Would I put that into manual to achieve what you, mm-hmm, just talked about?
Yeah, that's exactly what I would do.
Okay,
it's a little bit easier when you're doing macro work. I think you'll find. Try it both ways.
What this setting will do is that in the M/A function, autofocus is enabled, but if you just see that you need to touch it up a little bit, if you turn the focusing ring, it'll still let you override it. It's a manual override, and it'll take the image. If you slide that switch on your lens to the M position, it disables the autofocus entirely. And then, okay, you're in full manual mode. Mm-hmm. So that works.
Okay.
Well, that exhausted my questions that I had for now, but yeah. I know I've got a lot more.
Well, so. I'll tell you, it's what, our pleasure. We'll have you back, because that was good. You did a great job. We'll have you back and we'll talk a little bit about printing, you know, and how to get the image that you saw on your computer screen onto the paper, which is, you know, a whole challenge in itself. Not hard once you learn how to do it, but a little bit intimidating at first. And then we'll do a little bit more about flash.
Sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks, Renzo. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Glad you could come by.
All right. Well, I think that wraps up this week's show. And one of the things that we'll do in our next episode, I think, is our annual shopping list for the holidays. So be prepared to get out your wallet.
Yeah.
We'll apologize in advance.
That's right.
Anything else you can think of, Jason?
No. Hopefully we'll be able to talk about D3s and D300s soon enough.
Yeah, soon enough. Probably not the next episode, but maybe the one after that.
Hopefully by our Christmas time episode, yeah, we'll be able to talk, yeah, about it.
Ho, ho, ho.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us, everyone. And as usual, if you have a question to send us, don't forget to email the Image Doctors at talkradio@nikonians.org.
And as always, we appreciate the feedback on Podcast Alley under Nikonians Talk Radio.
Yep. And you can get those links just by going to the show notes page.
Right.
All right, we'll see you next time.
Thanks.